You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Your Royal Highness, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests, it's my great pleasure to welcome you this evening on behalf of the RSA to the RSA's President's Lecture, which is a real high spot each year in our annual calendar. This year, we're delighted that Professor Sir Anthony Atkinson will speak to us on the theme of inequality, an issue that must be urgently addressed if we are going to achieve a fair and flourishing society and economy. But before we hear from him, it's my great pleasure and honour to ask you to join with me in first welcoming the Society's President, Her Royal Highness, the Princess Royal.
Well, my lords, ladies and gentlemen, fellows, and those of you further afield, thank you so much for joining us. It is a real pleasure to be, as part of my role as president here, to be allowed to introduce this lecture and remind ourselves what an important part of the RSA's year this event is. I'm particularly looking at the history of this organisation and its focus on a sustainable society in all its forms and all the pieces that come together to make that possible. The RSA, quite rightly, I think, now still believes that the time is right for that wide-ranging debate about the kinds of social objectives we want our economy to be helping a nation to achieve by, say, 2030. The changes in thinking and the approach that will be required to create such an economy. This is a bit of a guessing game, but we know that economists have a role to play in this. And the topic is certainly important to the RSA at the moment as we are developing a long-term programme on the theme of Economy 2030, what kind of economy will best enable people to live creative lives. So in that context, what better speaker than Professor Atkinson? And he's long been at the forefront of research on inequality, why it matters, how it has changed over time, and how it can be addressed. And his latest book, which was published in April this year by the Harvard University Press, is entitled Inequality, What Can Be Done? And I think you may be, if you haven't already received one, about to get one so that you can study in easier time. I have to admit that I've only got as far as the first page and the proposals at the end, but gives me reasonable scope on what's in between, but that may take longer. You have, of course, been a fellow of the Nuffield College, Oxford, and you were warden there from 1994 to 2005, and he's currently centennial professor at the London School of Economics, and I have another hat as Chancellor of the University of London, so I'm really pleased that he's joined us today. And president, of course, of the Royal Economic Society, of the Econometric Society and the European Economic Association and of the International Economic Association. So I suggest that really we're in very good hands at the, in order to provide us with plenty of food for thought, an introduction to his book, and as we embark on our own inquiry. So, Professor Atkinson, thank you, and we very much look forward to hearing your lecture, in this President's Lecture. Thank you.
Your Royal Highness, ladies and gentlemen, thank you, ma'am, for a very kind introduction. And I can assure you, I think you've read more of my book than some of the reviewers. Now, you mentioned 2030, but I actually like to start by going back in time, 50 years, in fact, since last month saw a 50th anniversary, which went largely unnoticed. On the 5th of April 1965, there was a meeting of what later became the Child Poverty Action Group. Over 50 years, the group has campaigned to bring to public attention the extent of child poverty and provided practical help in the form of welfare advice. And in this, it's worked alongside important charities like Save for the Children, which you remember, been president for many years. Now, That was 50 years ago. During the recent general election, we heard little about child poverty. Was that because child poverty has disappeared? And the answer, as I'm sure you know, is no. In 1965, there were 1.9 million children living below the poverty line in Britain. Today, the figure is close to 4 million. And that child poverty is higher today than 50 years ago is part of a wider picture of increased inequality. Children are growing up in poverty because their mothers and fathers do not earn a living wage or cannot get jobs. If we look at the statistics of overall income inequality, and I'll show you, I won't be spending a lot of time on statistics, then if we look at those statistics, we find a stark picture. Measured in looking at overall income inequality in terms of the Gini coefficient, which summarises the extent of income differences among the population in a score that goes from zero when everyone has the same income to 100% at the other extreme. In the 1960s, that value of inequality was around 25%. And it had been that for quite a long time and remained that for quite a long time. But after 1980, it rose, and it rose to about 35%. There's been a 10 percentage point increase in the extent of inequality. And to put that in perspective, if we tried to use income tax alone to reduce inequality back to its level when the Beatles were playing, we'd have to raise all income tax rates by something like 16 percentage points, 16 pence in the pound. And if you were Chancellor of the Exchequer, going into the House of Commons, I think you'd take a very deep breath before announcing such a tax rise. So I'm afraid the fact of the matter is that income inequality in this country took a step up in the 1980s and has not fallen significantly since then. But it's only recently that this has come to be widely discussed. It was following the publication of Thomas Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century. There's been, in fact, enormous media coverage. It's attracted the attention of world leaders. The United States president, to quote Barack Obama, says that rising income inequality is the defining challenge of our time. The Pope has called for governments to redistribute wealth to the poor. And Christine Lagarde, head of the International Monetary Fund, has declared that reducing inequality is a priority since she sees it as threatening the stability and sustainability of the world economic system. But what world leaders have not said is what they would do about it. And that's why I wrote the book to which you kindly made reference, ma'am, entitled What Can Be Done? And some people say that nothing can be done. But I don't believe that, and in the book I tried to tell a more upbeat story. And the key message is that the present levels of inequality are not inevitable. We're not at the mercy of forces outside our control. If we want to reduce inequality, and that's, of course, a big if we want to do so, then there are concrete steps we can take, and in the book I make 15 proposals along those lines. They're not necessarily easy, and they have costs. We'd have to discard quite a lot of economic and political orthodoxy. But if our leaders are serious about tackling it, then they have to move outside their comfort zone and consider a wider agenda. What are these measures? Now, just to reassure you, I won't discuss 15 of them in my allotted time. It would be quite impossible. But let me just say something about some of the most important. Some of them are, in fact, familiar instruments of taxation and redistribution. Now, you may say, why is he talking about taxation when the country has just voted to reject a policy of higher taxation? But it's not just a question of the level of taxation. It's a matter also of the structure of taxation and whether it's designed to be in line with the goals of our society. To give one example, I propose a major reform of the taxation of wealth transfers through gifts and bequests. At the moment, we tax people on the amount that they give on your estate when you die or gifts you make before them. I would like to change that into a tax on the amount that people receive, so that people are taxed, for example, on the total received over their lifetime in gifts and bequests. And what this would do is to underline the fact that the tax is a levy on inherited advantage, and that it would only be paid when that advantage is concentrated. After all, in that system, a donor could give a large amount of money away, providing it's divided amongst a lot of people. And this is, I should say, far from a new idea, as indeed many of the ideas in the book are ones that other people have had. This is an idea that John Stuart Mill put forward in the 19th century, someone, of course, who was very much concerned with individual liberty. And he saw liberty as being underpinned by the diffusion rather than the concentration of wealth. Equally, I propose that the revenue from the new wealth transfer tax should be used to fund a minimum inheritance for all on reaching the age of 18, so that people would receive a capital sum which they could use to pay for their education, pay for example, a down payment on housing, or to set up a small business. After all, there's nothing wrong with inheritance. It's just that most people inherit very little. What about Social Security and the talk of cutting welfare benefits? The word welfare benefits seems to have been imported, I think, from the United States. And I much prefer the term Social Security, which describes the purpose of our social insurance system. As Lord Beveridge said in his plan of 1942, the abolition of want requires social insurance and redistribution towards families with children. Here, in terms of our social policy, I feel we've lost our way, and I think have been too much influenced by the United States, whose record on things like child poverty, for example, is much worse than ours. I believe, in fact, that the social security system needs radical rethinking. We need a welfare state fit for, not when Beveridge was writing, but for the 21st century. How would it be different? Well, in the book I describe the possibility of a citizen's income espoused by the Green Party, but where I depart in that eligibility would be based not on citizenship, which I think actually in this context wouldn't work, but on participation, where participation would be defined quite broadly to include employment, self-employment, but also activities like caring for children, young children, or for people with disabilities or people in old age who are in need of care. Everyone who participates in this sense in British society would receive a participation income, which in fact would be no different, actually, in the sense of everyone receiving it, from the fact everyone working or participating in British society receives a personal tax allowance. The only difference is that how much the tax allowance is worth to you depends on your income. If you're for example, in the 40% income tax range, then it's worth something like £80 a week at the moment. If you're in the basic rate band, it's worth half of that. And if you're below the tax threshold, it's worth still less. And what the participation income would do is to replace this by an equal cash amount, so all adults would get the same benefit. And child benefit would provide for children, and I would argue that it should once again be paid for all children. In fact, I think a generous child benefit is an essential ingredient in any campaign to tackle child poverty. But it's not just taxes and spending. One of the key messages of the book is that it's not feasible to reduce inequality just by taxes and spending. Nearly half of the proposals deal with the market distribution of income, that is, with the wages people earn and with the income they get from their savings. If one's concerned about inequality, then one can't be intensely relaxed, to coin a phrase, about what the market throws up in terms of rewards. Now, what does that mean? It means, first of all, tackling unemployment. And to me, it's actually astonishing that this subject is so missing from the public debate. We seem to have forgotten that there was a time when unemployment in this country was around 1%. I can remember as a student, we were horrified by suggestions it might rise to 2.5%. And yet, we today accept 5% as apparently a satisfactory and acceptable level. I remember, in fact, at that time, the Prime Minister of New Zealand was reported as saying that he knew personally all of the unemployed people in his country. I must confess, being a somewhat pedantic academic, I did go and check the figures, and at the time there were 55 people in New Zealand unemployed, so it's possibly true. So the first proposal I make under this heading is that the profile of unemployment should be raised by establishing an explicit government target for unemployment, just as we have an official target for inflation. And I'm not alone in suggesting this. Other economists, for example, Simon Wren-Lewis of Oxford, has said the Bank of England should be given a dual mandate, not just a single mandate, but a dual mandate which includes the objective of maximising the level of employment. And indeed, the fairly new governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, has already started talking about unemployment in his speeches. But how would such an ambition of reaching unemployment, an unemployment target, be realised? Here, I think we have to recognise that the measures taken in the past 30 years or so have failed to return us to the kind of levels we had in the 1960s and 70s. Labour market reform has not been the solution. We've seen considerable curtailment of the power of trade unions, particularly in this country. We've seen the level and coverage of unemployment benefit being greatly reduced, but we've not found it possible to get unemployment down. And I think, in my view, this is because we focused almost exclusively on the supply side of the labour market. And in the book, I concentrate quite a lot on the demand side and indeed make the radical proposal that the government should act as an employer of last resort. After all, if banks are too important to fail, so I think should be our citizens. And I should say also, this is not perhaps as revolutionary a proposal as might seem. The US Congress in 1978 passed legislation empowering the president to do exactly this. He didn't actually act on it, but nonetheless, the powers were there. But jobs are not enough. The level of pay is also important, as illustrated by the fact that just half of the unemployed in the European Union finding work earned enough in that job they found to be above the poverty line. In-work poverty is a major problem. Many children are living in families where the breadwinners do not earn enough to escape poverty, and that's why in the book I support, among other things, the living wage campaign. But why are there low wages? What has caused the widening pay gap? In most introductory economics textbooks, you'll find a simple supply and demand explanation. Increased inequality is due to the demand for educated and skilled workers rising faster than the supply. And 40 years ago, the Dutch economist Jan Tinbergen described a race between education increasing the supply and the demand growing because of technological change, which was requiring more and more people with skills. And of course, today's story includes also the effects of globalisation having much the same effect, in particular, meaning that many jobs in which low-skilled workers are engaged are disappearing. Now, this standard supply and demand story is accompanied by the policy prescription that's on the lips of most policymakers. We need to invest more in education and training. And I fully support these. I mean, this is to me absolutely right. We need, and very much in the spirit of the RSA, we need to invest in human capital. And I suppose after a lifetime in higher education, I could hardly suggest otherwise. But I think it's only part of the story. And I want to spend the last part of my talk saying why I think it's only part of the story. The first reason it's only part of the story is that these are not exogenous forces arriving from somehow from outside our planet. We are not, as I said earlier, powerless in the face of these changes of technological change and globalization. And most of the technical advances we've seen, like, for example, the smartphone, reflect decisions that were made by businessmen, by investors, by governments, and by consumers. And all of these determine what direction technical progress takes and whether it favours skilled or unskilled workers, or more generally, whether it favours capital or labour. And this raises the key question as who makes these decisions and whether they reflect the interests of all the stakeholders. And it's my contention that if we leave the decisions purely to companies and to shareholders, then we shall end up in a world in which technology does not serve the wider objectives of society. And to give a perhaps rather fanciful or extreme example, a company might decide that it can cut the costs of supplying meals on wheels by developing delivery by drones. It would still mean that the elderly and housebound got their meals, but of course that would change the nature of the service. They wouldn't have the human contact, which is an essential part of that service as I see it today. Now that's an extreme example, but I think we are seeing, and you may reflect on your own experiences, we're seeing many of the technological advances are actually reducing the human component of the service. Although I'm glad to see that the fight back has started, in that I noticed that one of the participants this evening is the vice president of Etsy, a peer-to-peer e-commerce website, where they say what we are doing is trying to put people back into commerce. And that is, I think, something which is obviously has implications not just in terms of that particular market, but also in terms of the demand for labour and the jobs in different sectors of the economy. So one of our proposals is that the direction of technical change should be a matter in which we take an active interest, not take it as granted, and that, for example, in terms of the government, it means inequality is a matter not just for the Department for Work and Pensions, but also, for instance, for the Minister for Science. After all, the government has funded much of the research. For example, one of the inventors of the touchscreen, which is an essential part we will carry around in our pockets, is someone who worked at the Royal Radar Establishment at Malvern. Now, the second way in which I depart from the textbook view is that I don't believe that the labour market should be understood purely in terms of supply and demand. Market forces place limits on the determination of pay, and there remains considerable role for social norms and for bargaining power. As the American Nobel Prize winner Robert Solow said, the labour market is different from other markets because it's a social institution. Now, I quoted Solow in my book, to which, in his blog a couple of months ago, the Director of Policy and Strategy here at the RSA, Anthony Painter, made some kind references. He referred to the book as formidable. Now, I'm not quite sure how to interpret that, whether that in fact was meant as a kind reference or not, I don't know. And the word formidable, to me, conjures up the picture of sort of great aunts expressing their disapproval. But he does indeed make some criticisms of the book, some of which I agree, in fact, are well taken. In particular, I should have been clearer, I think, about my proposal for a social and economic council. First of all, I should have underlined the word order, which is not alphabetical. Social comes before economic. Now, you're probably relieved that I've not accompanied my talk by a PowerPoint presentation. If I had, I would have probably had a slide which has the words economic and social, one above the other, with an arrow going from economic to social. And that is very much the way in which policy has tended to be made. It's the economic that has driven the social. And you see that in terms of government departments. I mean, the Treasury outranks the Department for Work and Pensions. But it's, in my view, the wider social objectives that should govern the formulation of policy. The arrow should run the other way, up, not down, in terms of my invisible slide. Economic goals should follow from the kind of society in which we should like to live. I should equally have emphasised that I'm not proposing a return to the 1970s with a socio-economic council limited to a tripartite representation from employers, trade unions and government. Rather, I would see a wider body with representation from NGOs, from groups such as CPAG and Save the Children, from bodies such as the RSA, and from consumers as well as workers and employers. And this council, I feel, could advise on important issues as far as inequality is concerned, such as the level of the living wage, ethical pay policies, and trade agreements such as the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. These are all subjects on which we need a national conversation, not decisions behind closed doors. As you said, ma'am, in your opening remarks, the RSA is developing a programme on the theme of Economy 2030, what kind of economy will best enable people to live creative lives. And I understand the RSA is encouraging a wide-ranging debate about our social goals and their relation to the performance of the economy. I hope that the ideas which I've mentioned, described briefly in this talk, and developed more in the book, will contribute to such a welcome ambition, an ambition which I heartily endorse. Thank you very much.
Sally, thank you so much for that. Let me start by asking you why it is you think that inequality has leapt to such prominence. I mean, it's something that you've given most of your academic career to, but I know that the Conservative MP David Davis is writing a book about inequality. I picked up today a book by Steve Hilton, David Cameron's former chief advisor. It has a chapter about inequality. Is it just because of the statistics and awareness of the statistics, or do you think that something else is going on to make inequality, put inequality back at the top of the agenda?
Good. Well, it sounds like it was good to get in publishing in April rather than later, from what you just said. But, yes. I mean, I think it's partly that it has taken time for the changes that took place, as I said, going back through to 1980 or thereabouts, to have full effect. I think it's also partly that I didn't sort of explain the reasons why I and others are concerned about it, but I think there's a sort of coalition which is partly about what I think people see as the possible economic and social costs of inequality, which the IMF, for example, are increasingly concerned about. But also I think that a more general concern, particularly about inequality of opportunity, which, for example, in the United States, I've noticed the reviews of the book have picked up with quoting not Democrat but Republican senators who say, I'm concerned about inequality of opportunity. I mean, that's the way they see it. And I think what I was doing in the book was saying, yes, I agree, but it's actually quite difficult to get inequality, to reduce inequality of opportunity without doing something also about inequality of outcomes. And so the two, I think, are linked. And when you see that link, then you become concerned about some of the things which I raised.
One of the reasons that some people argued we shouldn't talk about inequality anymore was the idea that the idea of inequality and the idea of poverty had become disconnected, in the sense that to be poor in the modern world was very different than to be poor in the previous world. And one notices that when Joseph Rowntree or others publish a list of the things which they consider to be essential items, there is a kind of response that says, well, you know, surely a flat screen TV is not an essential item. So yes. Tell us about that argument about whether or not poverty should be seen as something that is absolute or relative. Obviously, your measure is a relative measure.
Yes, and I think there is a distinction between, say, the World Bank's ambition to concern with the bottom billion who are living below $1.25 a day. That is, I think, a different, qualitatively a different level of poverty than the one at the time discussing. But I think your reference to Rowntree is, I think, an interesting one, because if you look at the list of things that he was included to build up his minimum allowance, and then you ask yourself, can you in fact buy these things today? You'll discover there are quite a lot of things which you have considerable difficulty in finding, because, for example, cuts of meat, which you can't now get from the butcher, you can't get lamb oil, there are all sorts of things where you have to go to a specialist shop to do it. And that, of course, is part of thinking about poverty in terms of people's ability to take part in the society in which they're living. And people today are not living in the 1900 with a round tree. They're living in a society where it's actually it doesn't necessarily need a touch TV screen, but it doesn't, to live, to take part in society. For example, to get a job. I mean, it's quite hard, I suspect, now to get a job if you don't have a mobile phone. And Roundtree certainly never thought about that. And so I think the goods and services you need to take part in society, to do things like finding a job or to care for your relatives and so on, are different from those in the past. And that means that it is indeed true that the amount of money is more than it would have been in 1900.
I was looking at the idea. I think for someone on basic income support, it would require them to spend about 10% of their monthly income to have broadband connection, which is an example, I guess, of one of those things which obviously didn't exist in Joseph Rowntree's time. So there seems to be a shift amongst politicians and observers around this issue of inequality, but yet there is still a great harshness, if that's not too emotive a word, in the public's attitudes often to the poor, particularly to those on benefits. What do you think is going on there? And do you subscribe to the view, which is that we have to have a welfare state or a social security system which has a stronger element of reciprocity and responsibility built into it to deal with that sense, which often seems strongest amongst those people who are just above the poverty line, that the welfare state is, as it were, a something-for-nothing system?
Well, that's one of the reasons I suggested a participation income rather than citizen's income, in the grounds that... I think there are problems about citizenship in the sense we don't actually know how many British citizens there are, which is, as I say, make it administratively rather difficult to run it. But also, I think it is embodied in that is a notion of reciprocity, yes, that... people are entitled by virtue of their contribution. And I think it's a shame in many ways, and I think some of the public attitude you just described has come about because we've weakened the connection between contribution and benefits. We used to have benefits, beverages, plans to provide social insurance benefits for people who contributed. And you had to have had your stamps and everything else, otherwise you didn't get the national insurance benefit. And we've weakened that because, in fact, we've cut, for example, the unemployed contributory element is now a very small part of the payments to the unemployed are actually from a contribution basis. It would also deal with issues about people moving to the country and so on as well. There are all sorts of things which we've actually made harder for ourselves by moving away from the earlier system, which was a notion of insurance, and it was a notion that people were protecting themselves and their families by contributing when working and would be entitled to benefits. So we, in many respects, social insurance could be looked at like other insurance, and you feel aggrieved if your insurance company wouldn't pay up because they thought you were not working hard enough or whatever. And I think that, and that's a shame. I think we've lost that, and as a result, most benefits are now not related to contributions, and that's, I think, one of the factors why public hostility has grown.
And is it also, Tony, to do with our perceptions of who the poor are? Your colleague at the LSE, John Hills, has written, as I'm sure you know, a book recently, exploring this idea, because there is again a common perception that those who are in poverty, those who are on benefits, have always been on benefits. Nobody has worked for generations in their families, when in fact, as you said in your speech, a high proportion of people in poverty are in work, and also many of those who aren't in work have been in work quite recently. But we seem to have developed a peculiar view of who the poor are.
Yes, and I think that John Hills's book is interesting. So he does bring out the evidence as to why this popular view is, in fact, misleading. I mean, a quite small fraction of our social security expenditure goes, for example, on people who are out of work, who are unemployed. And I'm afraid, all due respect to any representatives of the media here, I think that they've not presented, on the whole, a very balanced picture. And that's not helped a great deal in this respect.
I mean, your book, it feels to me, being slightly patriotic about this, is more full of policy suggestions that are credible and worth exploring than Piketty's book, which was the key book about inequality last year. He had fewer ideas. But there is, in a sense, a similarity in the responses that both books received, which is Lots of praise and recognition, a consensus around your description of the nature of the problem. But of course, as soon as we get to solutions, this consensus dissolves. And it seems to me it's not just that people disagree with the specifics of your proposals, which they are, of course, entitled to do, but it's that there's almost a kind of shrugging about the possibility of doing anything at all about this. There's a gap between a recognition of the problem and the degree to which we believe we have the capacity to solve it, particularly if that involves anything that is radical or anything that involves people losing as well as winning. Why do you think we have that? We lack the confidence to believe we can solve a problem like this.
Yes, and I wrote the book, I suppose, partly to argue against that. But I think it's partly that, for some reason I don't understand. I mean, the political discussion has become very narrowly focused, and there hasn't been much scope for ideas which are outside the box. And I think that's true of political parties generally. I mean, I don't think it's particular to one particular party. What I think, on the other hand, is partly the role of academics is actually to say, well, there are these things out there, and there's a menu from which you can choose. And it's not the academic's role, as it were, to try and persuade people to adopt one or the other, but to say, well, look, have you thought about this? And a lot of people have come up to me and said, well, actually, I'd never thought about that before. And that, I think, makes it worthwhile, although I think it'll be a long time. Probably a long time, although, in fact, if you go down the list of them, quite a lot of them are part of current discussion, actually, if you get down to it. And others, I think, are close to concerns. Like, for example, I mean, one of my departures from the Piketty book is that I'm quite concerned that didn't say enough about encouraging wealth and savings amongst people who haven't got any wealth and savings. And I think, for example, that, in fact, people wrote to me after his book came out saying, he's talking about the rate of interest being higher than the rate of growth, but look at my bank statement. My rate of interest is minus something, although when I allow for inflation. And people for the last 5 to 10 years in this country have basically been paying banks to look after their money. And I think that's something which is a rather straightforward point, which, when you explain it, people are going to say, yes, perhaps we should go back to having indexed savings and other things of the sort, which we used to have 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
Okay, let me open it up to questions from the floor. We'll start with the aforementioned Anthony Painter, the author of the blog.
Just to explain the use of the word formidable, I meant it in two senses. One is in the original French sense, that it's a wonderful book, but two, in the more modern English sense, that there's something daunting about it, not in terms of the material that's in it, but in terms of the challenges that it poses to us as a political and social culture. I think that's an important thing, but nonetheless, you know, the practicalities are important. Just one question, and you make this important distinction we've just kind of touched on in the book between wealth and capital. Wealth being non-productive assets, effectively, and capital being productive assets. How important do you think it is that people have access to capital as part of the story in combating inequality?
That's an interesting question. I'm not quite sure I'd agree with the sort of classification of productive and non-productive, which just sounds vaguely Marxist and is overtones and so on. I think I would say it's rather it's the different stages of ownership of wealth. And I think the example I give in the book is, which affects probably many people in this room, people who have got pensions, various forms, they own capital assets, but only indirectly. My university pension fund is invested in all sorts of companies, and it's presumably the trustees who make decisions about whether to vote for the company's policies about whatever it is to do with the environment or his pay policy or something, whereas the real beneficiaries are the pensioners and the future pensioners. So there's been a sort of divorce between the decisions about, as it were, production and what companies do, which are in many cases very important in terms of what happens in terms of the range of products produced or whether they explore oil in different places or what they pay their chief executive. All these are important decisions, which are not the people who have the wealth, actually the final beneficiaries, don't have any say in it at all. And that's what concerns me. And I think that we've seen in this country a very substantial reduction in the concentration of the ownership of wealth, because, I mean,
it's been transformed over the last 100 plus years. 100 years ago, most people had no wealth at all, or hardly anything. But now most people have some savings, most people have pensions, many people have their own house. So we've transformed that. It hasn't transformed the control over the... They haven't got acquired with it the ability to influence the direction of the economy.
My name is Ian Young. I'm a fellow of the Institute, and I work for the Institute of Chartered Accountants. And the new government has its first budget on the 8th of July, and the Treasury has asked for suggestions, two major suggestions, by the 5th of June as to what we think they ought to put in the budget. So from your... And I, unlike the Royal Highness, I'm afraid I haven't read either the beginning or the end of your book, but I bought a copy, so I will read it on my way home and continue. So if you've picked out two major suggestions to transform the situation in the UK, what would they be?
Two of your 15, Tony. It means you have to jettison the other 30.
Well, no, I think it was put in a slightly different way. It wasn't just to pick the two I would like. It was two that Treasury might like. Which I think...
That's a different matter.
Yeah, so I think I'd temper my answer by saying what might be realistically taken seriously by the government. I think two of the sort of most straightforward things they could do would be one thing to go back, as I said, to introducing index securities, which... and I think if savers knew they would get, as it were, some positive return from their savings, that would probably change people's attitudes to savings and might well... And it would mean that they could indeed begin to accumulate. And that, I think, would be something which I'd be surprised if there's a lot of opposition in the Conservative government to that. And I'm surprised, in fact, they haven't done it already, I must confess. And the other thing is, which they may not like to do, because if, in fact, was something they abolished, but I did feel that the child trust funds under the previous government were a beginning of something which was meant that people, when they got to 18, would have something available for meeting their university fees or for other forms of starting out in life. And I think that... I don't know if you were involved in that.
It was my greatest achievement, and then it wasn't anymore.
Yeah. So I think that would be a second one, which it means a certain amount of swallowing pride, as it were, but I think that would be, anyone who's concerned about inequality of opportunity, that would be a beginning of a step. So those are two things, which, of course, you'll probably now say to me, I'm spending money in both cases, but that's, but nonetheless, that would be...
Charlie Mayfield, John Lewis Partnership. The implication of your speech, and I'm afraid I haven't also read your book yet, but I will, is that the inequality is getting worse. And I just wanted to check that you do think that. And if you do, what do you see as the most significant drivers of that accelerating trend?
I'm sorry, I should have been clearer. I don't think I did say that. In a sense, what I said was inequality now is higher, significantly higher than it was. In fact, in this country, at least until 2012, there's not been much change from about the end of the 90s in the overall sense. Unlike, say, the United States, where it has continued to go up. So I'm not making... I think I must be careful. Well, it's not a sort of situation where there's some inexorable trend upwards. But for the last 20-odd years, it's been a combination of two things. One is... It is true that at the top shares of income have been going up on the whole. On the other hand, certainly for quite a lot of the period, in fact, starting before Matthew was involved in the government, poverty was going down, and as people, child poverty particularly, was falling, and even starting in the major government, there was some improvement. So there's been, as were the problem of inequality is a somewhat subtle combination of different movements. And I think for the same reason, when I talked about the reasons for it, I was trying to say I don't think these things are inevitable and completely sort of out of our hands. And that, for example, the impact of globalization on the British economy is, or on British society, is not something which is beyond the influence of our own government. And I think that there are, in fact, if you read, for example, the report of the Migration Advisory Committee last year about the impact of migration on the labour market and looked at the list of things they suggested could be done, most of those things were things that the British government can do. They're not constrained by international either membership of the EU or by globalisation forces. One of them was, but five of them were quite things which were within the power of the government.
Mary Gilley, as an engineer, I was quite pleased to see an economist who had technology in the title of a talk. And I think you made a very good point about the fact that technology shouldn't necessarily remove the human element out of tasks. But then you seem to sort of skate over it when we came to policy. So I'm wondering, on the micro level, how would you see that you can include the societal and environmental side to any brief for an engineer? But then on a macro level, how do you include that in the policy for sort of industry to actually make sure that our industry as part of the economy actually improves society and the environment that we live in?
A question that deserves a book in itself, I would have thought.
Yeah, it's a very good question. I'm not sure I can give you I will probably skate in the answer as well as in my talk. I think the kind of thing I had in mind, and I should also say that there are people much more expert than I am, and particularly at Sussex, the Science Policy Research Unit, doing very interesting work in this. But the kind of thing I had in mind is that if you think about the range of products that a firm is producing, those products can vary in the mix of technology and people. Now, in some cases, it doesn't matter. I mean, a good example, which I experienced in Oxford talking to someone who works at the BMW works, is that putting robots in the paint shop is, on the whole, a jolly good idea, because basically painting cars is a dangerous and dirty and place. And it doesn't make any difference to the person with the car, whether the car was painted by a robot or by a person. But, of course, that's why, because it's an intermediate good. It isn't something which... But most things which the consumer directly consumes, there is a mix of people and machinery. And I think that's a decision which a company can make between the mix of products and what the instructions are given to people in terms of development. Do you want to develop? Do you want to get rid of people? I mean, that's sort of a straightforward way of putting it. Or are people important? And are you willing sometimes to pay a bit more for the people, which, of course, is the other part of it? I mean, I think that clearly, as inevitably as wages tend to rise, the people part becomes more expensive. But I think, for example... is it? I think an example would be the dispensing medicines, for example. Now, you could have pharmacies which are basically boxes, and you just go along and unlock the box and take out whatever it is you've been prescribed. But of course, that would miss then the fact the pharmacist would actually look at you and say, "Well, actually, this person looks rather young to be taking this, or rather old to be taking that, or this person is pregnant," and should they be taking this, or the person wants some advice about what to take. All of that would disappear if we moved over to automated pharmacies. Now, that, of course, is partly then up to consumers, because I mean, consumers have then to pay a bit more to get it, or the governments have to pay a bit more for the National Health Service or whatever.
Wow, look at all those hands. And we've got 5 minutes left, so I have to arbitrarily choose somebody, and I will, arbitrarily choose the lady there, because I think her hand's been up for a while. I'm very sorry for the rest of you.
I'm Jo Pyatt from the Organisation for Responsible Businesses. Can I ask you, how do you think the skills gap has impacted on unemployment and therefore inequality? And if you think that's a major problem, how do we deal with it?
Well, I think fairly clearly it has, in the sense that, as I probably know better than I do, there are lots of businesses that claim they can't get people of certain skill levels and so on, and I'm sure that's clearly true. And then you have to ask why that is, and that then raises questions about the nature of the education system and so on. But also, I mean, I can remember, this is a bit of autobiography, when I left school in 1962, whatever it was, I went to work for IBM, and I was taken on as a systems analyst. I had no training whatsoever in this. And at that time, there was no training. You couldn't do a course in computing. There was no training at all. And somehow they managed to construct the people I worked with are all kinds of backgrounds, different backgrounds. Someone come, I think there'd been a merchant seamen or someone, I mean, all sorts of different backgrounds. And in a way, that was the full employment, perhaps, had driven employers to try and look for people who could do these things and invested a lot in their training. So, I mean, it was almost the other way around, that the full employment had generated the training rather than the training causing the unemployment. Now, that's clearly not the case today, but I think that there are, we perhaps need to be more flexible in terms of, for example, of what kind of qualifications we expect people to have and how much investment can be put by employers, particularly, into making people able to do jobs, and which... So I think it's, as I said in my talk, it's the demand side of the labour market. And I, again, just anecdotally, when I was running a college, which was a small outfit, but I was an employer, I felt actually no pressure, really, for example, to employ people, even, you know, take on apprentices. There was no sort of social pressure on me to do that. And I think that's something perhaps we ought to think about, that actually it's the role of employers in all of this is I think, often undervalued and understated. And they're very important, I think, in this story.
Tony, thank you very much. Thank you for your questions. Sorry, again, to those whose questions I was unable to take. Please finally join me again in thanking our excellent speaker, Professor Tony Atkinson.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.